yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Wow, what a week, huh? Coronavirus, stock market flipping 1,000 points up and down here all week long, and I guess almost 1,000 down early this morning here, Friday, March 6th. Still 500-600 points down. And then, of course, on the political side, we had this just as noteworthy development here with the Super Tuesday and the primaries. And it looks like a two-horse race now. And we'll talk about that in the second half of the show. But I want to jump right into what's going on here economically, because I believe we are on the brink here of the next recession. As you know, I've been predicting for over a year now that the recession would come fourth quarter of last year. Well, I think I missed it by a quarter or two, not too bad. And I stand by that forecast. All the talk about the effect of the coronavirus being a brief V-shaped event is pretty much being dissipated now. Not too many folks believe of that happy talk, wishful thinking. This thing is having a major, major effect. And what I want to talk about is how it is deepening day by day in terms of its effect, not just the stock market. By the way, the stock market today continued to fall, even though you got this jobs report that showed robust jobs growth. I don't believe those numbers in the job report anymore. I've talked about that many times and what's wrong with the changed economy and the failure of the Labor Department to accurately estimate the jobs. So I'm not going to go into that. But the fact is the news showed a big increase in jobs, but the market just blew right through that, collapsing. And, of course, we had the similar event earlier in the week. The Federal Reserve lowered the interest rate, you know, the benchmark rate, federal funds rate is called, by 50 basis points. In other words, 0.5%. Nothing happened. In fact, the markets continued to collapse. What this tells you, these events with the Fed and with the jobs and so forth, is that investors are rushing headlong into getting out of investment, financial investment, and behind it all, we'll see real investment, investment in plant and equipment and structures and inventories and so forth. This psychology going on is just so strongly embedded that very little is going to change it for the foreseeable short term here. We'll see some significant attempts, announcements in terms of fiscal stimulus, because it's very clear that monetary policy is dead in the water. They've shot all their ammunition off, especially in Europe and Japan and elsewhere. And by that, I mean they've reduced their interest rates to the governments and the Federal Reserve, their central banks, to less than zero, negative rates. You know, we've got, $17 trillion, last I heard, in negative rates out there globally. And most of it, of course, is Europe and Asia, Japan in particular. So they can't lower their rates. You know, the central bankers had this conference, I think it was in Doha, somewhere in the Middle East, right in the midst of all this emerging coronavirus thing. And they came back from that session, and that's when the U.S. Chair of the Federal Reserve, our central bank, Powell, his name, announced the 50 basis points, half a full percentage. You know, the Fed always made moves by a quarter percent, and up to now, a quarter percent move would cause the stock market to go up hundreds of points. Well, 50%, twice that, as I said, the stock market continued to plummet. So Powell comes back, and he announces that 50 basis point change, but none of the other central bankers announced anything. Well, that kind of spooked the markets. Well, they couldn't because they got negative interest rates. I mean, what are you going to do, drive it even deeper into negative area? I mean, the negative rates haven't done a damn thing for Europe or Japan. Japan's already was already in a recession as the fourth quarter last year. And Europe pretty much stagnated, although Germany and Italy were already entering a recession before all this virus stuff hit. And then Brexit, the impact of Brexit, still to be determined. And then, of course, this virus thing hits and we get the contractions going to deepen. But they can't lower their rates. They're already in negative territory. So as I said in my 2017 book, you know, central bankers are at the end of their rope. They were at the end of the rope back then. And why? Because they continuing reducing interest rates, even though the economy in the period, you know, from 2010 up to 2016 was not in recession in the U.S. And of course, Europe had a double dip recession 2011 to 13. And ever since then, you know, continuing to lower their interest rates, continuing to pump free money into the banks and non-banks with their QE, quantitative easing, which drives the interest rate down. You know, they just kept subsidizing the financial institutions and banks with free money. That's why I've said before that central bankers are at the end of the rope. They've shot their interest rate tool. You know, it's busted. The U.S. Was the only one that kept rates a little bit higher, and that was because in 2016 and 17, Powell and the U.S. Fed raised rates a little bit, but then they capitulated to Trump. And Powell, you know, gave in to Trump's demands for lower rates, and they lowered the rates again last year. And that's stimulated the stock market a little bit again. So the central bankers have thrown in the towel. Oh, okay, so now what they're going to do is throw more QE money, more free money at the banks and the financial system. They're just flooding the market. And what happens when you flood the market that long with free money and near zero interest rates, subsidize the banks, in other words, even in good times, what that happens is that most of them, that free money flows into financial markets, into stock markets, bond markets, derivatives, and so forth. It doesn't flow into real investment, i.e. plant and equipment and structures and inventories and software. Some of it does, but you know, maybe a fourth of it only. The majority of it flows into financial markets, causing these bubbles. And that's what, exactly what we got. We have these bubbles that are now bursting in stock markets and other financial markets. History will show, when you look back at the Trump years here, the stock market was driven to, you know, unsustainable heights under Obama. But then when Trump comes in, what does he do? He feeds it even further with his massive tax cuts, most of which went into financial markets again, and gets the Fed, browbeats the Fed to lower interest rates again. So you got this double whammy going on of free money which is then driven into the markets, causing the bubbles. Totally artificial. Artificial boom of stock markets in the U.S. under Trump. And because it's artificial, now we see it coming down even faster, right? It wasn't based upon real economic growth. It was based on this free money from two channels, fiscal and monetary. I mean, and you can see it in how much corporations fattened big time by both of these subsidy channels, just turned around and shuffled the money off to their shareholders, their investors, which include mostly in some industries like tech, the senior managers, the owners and senior managers of these companies. Trillions of dollars every year for 7-8 years on average, $1 trillion, last 2 years, $1.2 trillion each under the Trump regime, going to shareholders. $1.2 trillion, 2 years in a row. And in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Well, that drove the financial stock markets up to unsustainable heights. It was already too high when Trump comes in, but he takes it and he drives it to unsustainable, artificial bubbles. And now we see those bubbles unwinding. And once they unwind, it's almost impossible to stop them until they have their devastating effect. Because financial asset deflation has an impact on the real economy. You know, mainstream economists say that, that's the financial markets. There's nothing to do with real economy. Paul Krugman and folks say that. Well, not true. Not true. Because financial asset deflation ends up with a credit crunch. And the credit crunch then propagates the crisis into the real economy. That's what happened in 2008, 2009. And we're at the stage of seeing that once again. How far it will impact the real economy remains to be seen, but it's happening right before our eyes. Once again, how financial asset market instability precipitates a contraction in the real economy. It didn't cause it. There's a difference between precipitating causes and fundamental causes. And I would add even enabling causes, those three, and they are different. Fundamental cause is that, the real economy investment has not been all that great since 2009. Last year it contracted nine months in a row, and of course it's going to contract big time this quarter. So, the real economy is not really growing, and the financial economy begins to contract rapidly and deeply, and that spills over to the real economy that's not growing. Okay, let's look at what's happening today. Okay, stock markets, as I said earlier, down way more than 500, I think, still. Almost at midday here, and it swings throughout the day, and I think it probably will, good chance it'll go down to 800-900, unless there's some kind of a big announcement. You'll see a big announcement of some kind, fiscal stimulus over the weekend, to try to talk the markets from falling further. Right? But the big news today is if you look at what's happening with the Treasury bonds. Treasuries are a safety valve, Treasuries are where investors park their money because it's relatively safe in an interim. In other words, financial assets, they don't want to hold the financial asset that's collapsing in value, i.e. stocks, because they're just losing money. So they sell that and they move the money over into U.S. treasuries, a haven, or they put it into gold, or sometimes they move it into what's called currencies that are part of the carrying trade, like the yen. Well, it's not going into the yen, and it's not going today even into gold. It's all going into treasuries, and especially it's going into long-term treasuries, 30-year treasury bonds, which have collapsed an amazing 25, 30 basis points in one day, from 1.5% thereabouts, where it was 1.6, something like that, percent yield, to 1.29 last I looked here. You know, that's a 25 basis point collapse. The last time that happened, 2008. Yes. Okay, so we're on this trajectory, very similar in some ways. It's all beginning to look very much similar to 2008 in various ways, and increasingly so. Okay, so that's the big news, treasuries. And it's not just U.S. Investors converting to T-bonds, long-term T-bonds, but it's also offshore investors. As their currencies collapse with this global virus, and they were already pretty weak, then what you get is what's called capital flight. Investors in those countries, let's take Latin America, you know, and those investors include U.S. multinational corporations doing business there, and investors having invested in Argentine bonds and so forth. The currencies are collapsing. Who, once again, wants to hold an asset, a currency, a foreign exchange, a financial asset? Who wants to hold that when it's collapsing? They don't want to hold it. So they sell it. Oh, how do you sell a currency? Very easy. You know, in global markets, there's global markets for currencies. The global market, currencies exchange every day. The dollar global market for currency, the dollar, is like $4 to $5 trillion every day exchanges. So what they're doing is they're dumping the Argentine peso, right, and converting to dollars. Well, it used to be here in previous weeks that the dollar was rising while the other currencies were falling. Well, now the dollar is falling too because it's so weak in the U.S., but other currencies are falling faster. So you see, it's relative. It's all relative. And you get capital flight. Money, capital flows out of these emerging markets to the U.S. Guess where it goes? Goes into treasuries, safe haven. Mm. Oh, but capital flight out of those countries, those economies, mean that there's less to invest. And as their currencies decline, right, their inflation from imports rise. Then they raise their interest rates, their own central banks, to try to stem the outflow of money capital. But raising interest rates slows down their domestic economies even more. So you get this massive stagflation. The real economy slows down dramatically, but import prices rise dramatically. And in these economies, they're far more dependent on imports than the U.S. is. And you get this big problem of stagflation, recessions, deep recessions, and accelerating inflation. And then the IMF has to step in to help them stabilize their currency, and they get more in debt. And then the IMF says, oh, austerity, to pay the loans we're giving you, and they get even further in debt. Well, that's the dynamic that's going on here. Capital flight to the U.S. And that drives up the demand for U.S. treasuries, drives up the price of U.S. treasuries, and that in turn drives down the interest rate, the yield on U.S. treasuries, because the price and the yield move in opposite directions always. It's the way the bonds are set up. Okay, so what we probably got today with this unprecedented 2008-like rise in the price of 30-year treasury bonds is offshore money flowing into the U.S. Big time now. Okay, so what's important to understand, though, is that this stock market big contraction going on, right, begins to spill over to or flows in parallel to other asset price deflation. Other financial assets deflate as well. Look what's happening with oil. Oil is now well below the $50 a barrel level. I think it's going to $40, maybe less, because OPEC and the Saudis, who control about a third of the global crude oil, Russia another third, and the U.S. another third, roughly, and Russia and OPEC have had an agreement for about a year or so to try to restrict the supply, the production of oil, to help drive the price of crude oil up. The U.S. refused to participate in that. The fracking companies just kept pumping out the oil. And then the conditions here, slowing global economy, and now the virus effect is driving the price of oil, crude oil, down dramatically as well. And, of course, China, a good part of China's economy has pretty much stalled because of the virus. And the China economy is having stalled. Production has dropped off dramatically, and China is not taking shipments of industrial commodities like iron ore, and copper, and so forth. So other industrial commodity prices are deflating as well. Oil and energy collapsing because now there's no agreement between OPEC and Russia to reduce the supply of oil to drive up prices. That agreement broke down here yesterday, I believe it was. So no further cuts, and that signaled further deflation in crude oil prices, and then the China effect on that, and now other emerging market effects on that. Industrial commodities collapsing as well. When I say oil, industrial commodities, how are they a financial asset? Well, they are because there's trading and options and futures on these commodities, and it's the options, which are a financial asset, you see, collapsing. Commodities and oil have this characteristic. They're both a physical product, but they're traded as if they are a financial asset, and that price is collapsing for both. As I said, currencies are collapsing. The U.S. dollar is falling now, and other currencies that were falling are falling faster than the dollar. What happens to these emerging market economies when the 30-year Treasury bill or bond goes down to near zero, or the 10-year goes down to near zero? I mean, the 10-year is what, like 0.6 something maybe today? That's going to zero pretty quick. Are we going to slip into negative rates here in the U.S.? Could happen. So what you got here is the currencies, a financial asset, foreign exchange, a financial asset, right? Also collapsing here, both in emerging markets and in the U.S. So, you got bonds, by the way, treasury bonds and bills collapsing, pulls down corporate bonds as well. That's corporate bonds, $10 trillion of corporate bonds in the U.S. right now. Treasuries, $15 trillion. So that's $25 trillion in bonds, and the prices are going up and the rates going south. What happens next to bonds is that the worst bonds, in other words, the bonds that are the least stable, which are called junk bonds, right, or high-yield bonds. These are bonds that were issued by companies that were really shaky in the first place. Probably should have gone out of business, some of them. They just borrow bonds to expand or to stay afloat. And now they can't pay them off. A good example is what's happening with the fracking industry, the oil extraction industry in the U.S., which is responsible for most of the huge increase in oil and gas in the U.S., production in the U.S. These companies, which are not really large, a lot of them are just exploration and drilling companies, borrowed far more than they could pay off. And pay off in terms of principal and interest, in other words. So they're overextended, they're over-leveraged, as they say. And as the price of their product, oil, falls, they do not generate as much revenue needed to pay the principal and interest on these junk bonds that they owe. Well, when you don't pay the principal and interest, or either, you, quote, default. And when you default, no one will give you any further loans, and you go out of business. And then the bad loans sit on the balance sheets of the banks that issued or had issued lending to these companies, right? They end up with the bad asset. And if enough of these kind of bad assets accumulate in the banking system, then you get a credit crunch. And then banks don't loan even to companies that are in good financial state. And, you know, that's what happened in 2008. So what I'm describing is the process by which falling asset prices began to spill over to asset prices for unstable companies, like junk bond companies or companies that are maxed out in leveraged loans, which is kind of like a junk loan, you might say. It spills over to these kind of companies, and then these companies default, and that spills over to the banks themselves. They freeze up and don't lend in general, and now you've got the whole financial asset contraction propagating over into the real economy. Well, okay, how many junk bonds do we have out there? Well, I said a minute ago, total corporate bonds, about $10 trillion in the U.S. Well, if you look at junk bonds, you know, maybe $2 trillion, not a small number. But most of the good corporate bonds, which are called investment-grade bonds, are what's called BBB, corporate investment-grade bonds, which is really a kind of junk bond. Half of the investment-grade bonds are BBB. And you got to put the BBB in the same category as the junk bonds, I believe. The junk bonds will go first, then BBB will go in terms of default. Okay, what industries are these? Well, as I said, the U.S. energy industry, particularly fracking companies, have really loaded up on these junk bonds. But also the retail sector is up to their elbows here in junk bonds. Well, why? Why retail companies? You know, I'm talking about JCPenney's and Macy's and companies like that. Why are they? Well, because of what's been going on for a decade here with the internet and companies like Amazon and now Walmart and others online. The online evolution in retail has put these big box, as we call them, retail companies in great stress. And they are just hanging on. And they've hung on by taking out, issuing junk bonds to keep going during good times. And the more junk that they took on, the closer they get to their end of days here. And they hang on until you get an event like this where asset prices begin collapsing. By the way, I talked about this whole process of how financial assets and financial cycles impact real cycles and vice versa. Back in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, you can read reviews of that book on my blog and website, blog just jackrasmus.com. And from there, there's an icon. You can go to my website, and on the tab that says book reviews, you can read the book reviews about that book that describes this process I'm talking about. And also the subsequent book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, published in 2017, a year later, where I talked about all this subsidization going on through the central banks and how they are about at the end of their rope. So, you know, if you're interested in those books, you can read some reviews on them by others. Then, of course, the book I published here last month or in January, which is The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, which kind of pulls all those previous books together and looks at both fiscal policy, monetary policy under neoliberalism, and how it got to this point that we're at today, where neither fiscal or monetary policy have much of an effect going into the next recession that we're on the brink of. Okay. Back to the propagation from collapsing financial asset prices, oil, industrial commodities, currencies, into junk bonds, into leveraged loans, and that impacts then starts penetrating the real economy, and we'll see it with energy, U.S. energy companies, fracking companies, and retail companies. Behind all this, of course, are financial assets called derivatives. And it's hard to see what's going on there in terms of deflation because they aren't really reported publicly. But, you know, one of the derivatives of the day, of course, are exchange-traded funds, which are kind of combined bonds. You can get a bond ETF or combined stocks, and they're all collapsing. And then, of course, where do we go with other derivatives? You know, in 2008, it was the collapse of the derivatives market that really caused that crisis. Subprime mortgage bonds in 2007-08 were part of the derivatives market, but it wasn't until the derivatives collapsed that we really got the crisis. Okay, so we need to watch what's going on with financial asset prices. At some point, their collapse will spill over into these very unstable markets for junk bonds, triple Bs, leverage loans, derivatives. And that process is underway, by the way. And then, of course, as a corollary to all this, it quite well appears that the Fed's Monday or Tuesday, 50 basis points had no effect whatsoever. And those interest rates, the Fed will probably lower interest rates again later this month. It doesn't want to be blamed for everything going on, which Trump will do if they don't. So that's going down even further here, and we'll soon be at virtual zero or close to zero rates. And that will cause tremendous instability in emerging market economies. Okay. And other central banks won't lower their rates because they're already negative. So what you're going to see, and perhaps even this weekend, is some big announcement, coordinated maybe, by the advanced economies of a fiscal stimulus to try to stimulate the economy fiscally, because it's pretty clear monetary policy is dead, not going to have much effect. And they're going to have to do something fiscally. We can even see the tip of that iceberg can't we not, with Trump floating this idea of a payroll tax cut. In other words, suspend for a while the contribution of workers and companies into the payroll tax for Social Security. Obama did that. Disastrous effect. Caused the Social Security Trust Fund to evaporate its surplus, and it'll do the same. But, you know, Republicans like that because they don't want Social Security, and the way to justify massive changes in that program is to show that it's losing money. So you agree to cut the money flowing into it to make it look like it's even worse off than before. So we're going to see that tax, payroll tax cut. It's going to be hard for the Democrats to say no to that because their boy Obama already did it. So we'll probably see that before the election. We'll see more spending by Trump for his farm base, his farmers, because, you know, the China mini deal, $100 billion purchased this year, joke. They're lucky if they have $10 billion of Chinese purchase of U.S. farm goods, if that. So, you know, Trump has already subsidized the farmers, especially the big farmers. A lot of small farmers haven't benefited from his $28 billion of free money he's thrown at the farm sector during these trade war in the last couple of years with China. You know, this crisis now means that the farmers are going to need more, agribusiness is going to need more subsidy, and we'll see that passed here. This year, I don't know how much, maybe $10 billion more. Yeah, he'll spend $40 billion to bail out agribusiness, but he's cutting 1 million people out of food stamps. Yeah, well, someone's got to pay for it, right? But, you know, all this government spending, and we'll see more tax cut proposals as well. He's already has on the table, Trump does, a proposal to make his 2018 investor tax cuts permanent. You know, it's supposed to be for 10 years, but he wants to make it permanent. And he wants to index capital gains to inflation. In other words, greater tax cuts than even indicated in the bill, simply based, automatic, based on inflation. So we're going to see that. But, you know, there's a big problem here. We already have a $1 trillion deficit, you know, and more tax cuts, more spending is going to balloon that deficit even more. You know, we have a $1 trillion deficit and we aren't really officially in recession. Yeah, but we will be. So it'll be more than $1 trillion in deficit. Okay, just to conclude here on the effects of the virus and the contagion. As I said last show, I talked about the channels of contagion, right? Contagion from other places to the U.S. and U.S. economy. And, of course, the main channel here that people have been aware of is the supply chain, right? U.S. multinational companies moved around the world, moved their production of their parts and even final products offshore. You know, that's what free trade is all about. As U.S. multinationals move offshore, not to have to pay a tariff when they move the stuff back on shore to the U.S. to sell. That's why they have free trade. 49% of all the imports from China are from U.S. companies in China, joint production or whatever. So supply chain's been disrupted. A lot of intermediate goods come into the U.S. and North America, China. I mean, in Mexico, for example, auto parts. That's been disrupted. But it's not just China to the U.S. supply chain disruption. It's also China, South Korea, China, Japan. Even Japan now and South Korea have their own big problem with virus, have been unable to send the parts to their factories in China that would then send them back to those economies or to U.S. or the world. So the supply chains are being disrupted in combination, very complex, not just simply from one country to the other country. And that, of course, reduces production, right, which is just beginning to hit the U.S. Supply chain impacts. And what about another channel, the demand channel, not the supply chain, but the demand channel? Well, we see that happening already with the collapse of travel industries, hotels, tourism, airlines, and of course, cruise ships, those big incubators for the virus, right? You know, 1 million Chinese used to go to Japan on vacation. 1 million buy stuff, right? The wealthy Chinese go to Japan. Well, that's not happening anymore. That's all stopped. Well, that is a big tourist hit. You know, a lot of Chinese come to the U.S. or used to buy in the U.S., buy things. In San Francisco, they would come to San Francisco and buses would take them to these outlet malls in the Bay Area to purchase things in the U.S., you know, load up with all the goodies they could buy here and take it back to China. Yeah, they actually would have special dedicated buses every day going to outlet malls. There's a couple big outlet malls, and, you know, they cater largely to Chinese tourists. Well, that stopped, right? Those outlet malls are in big trouble, of course, retail, right? So on the demand side, you have the travel impact in various industries, and then you have other retail as in the U.S. they shut down. And New York City, I think they just announced some of the retail companies there in New York, Manhattan, are shutting down and telling their employees to work from home. Okay, so you have a production effect and you have a distribution effect, right? And then, of course, people aren't going to be buying as much gasoline to travel, even locally here. Restaurants, people aren't going to go to restaurants, public events and entertainment, vacations. None of that is going to be as it was in previous years. So there's the demand channel here. And as we have more announcement of virus problems in the U.S., and it's growing rapidly, by the way, and it's much, much larger than they're even saying, because they haven't had the test kits. No, they haven't had the test kits in the U.S., and from what I heard, some of the initial test kits were defective, and they had to call them back. You know, up until just a few days ago, if there was a suspected person with the virus, you would, the state governments, local governments would have to test them and send the test results to Atlanta to the Centers for Disease Control to tell them if it was, yes, a coronavirus or not. They would have to do it that way. And, you know, there just weren't enough test kits. And last I heard, it was only 1,200 in all of California. Maybe it's gone up. Trump has promised 1 million test kits by the end of this week. Of course, there's nowhere near that. So the point is, you don't know how many people are really infected with this. And the reports of infected are people with very extreme symptoms, and deaths, of course, follow extreme symptoms. But there's undoubtedly maybe 10 times as many people walking around with the virus already. Some of them, of course, show very light symptoms. Some show none at all, but they are carriers. And this is a very contagious virus, very contagious. And, of course, the death rate, they say, is 3.4. World Health Organization and Trump has been saying, oh, no, it's nowhere near that. It's only a couple tenths of 1% like a typical flu. Well, it's not. It's very contagious. Okay. So we have the demand channel as well as the supply chain problem. And then, of course, I've been talking about these two channels that you don't hear much talk about, and that's the financial asset deflation channel. that has an effect on financial asset markets across the board, but then eventually has an effect on credit and spills over to other financial assets like junk bonds, leveraged loans, repos, and so forth. Okay. And then you get the credit crunch and you get the contagion propagating into the real economy. Manufacturing already, you know, supply chain impacts, soon credit impacts, services, certain services sectors, entertainment, restaurants, and so forth, shutting down. All right. So we need to watch that closely, but investors kind of know that this is what's going on. This is the direction of what's going on, and they're responding similarly. Okay, let's move on to talk about a little bit about the political side. What's happened this past week? Well, Super Tuesday, right? And Biden comes back to life, wins 10 states, right? States in which Sanders was leading by a large margin, like Texas and everything, all of a sudden flip and go to Biden. Well, how the hell did that happen? Well, what happened was the leaders of the Democratic Party got their act together, right? And they political wannabes to drop out. Yeah, who dropped out after South Carolina? Well, Klobuchar dropped out and Buttigieg dropped out immediately, and Steyer had dropped out even a day before that. All one day before Super Tuesday, and then they come out and they announce they're supporting Biden. Surprise, surprise. Right. Well, as I've been writing on my blog, jackrasmus.com, an analysis of each of these events, you know, the caucuses events there, particularly with what went down in Nevada, and then the debate that occurred right before the South Carolina primary, and then the South Carolina primary, and then, of course, Super Tuesday. There's three or four analyses I've written. They're on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Take a look at them, my analysis. Well, my analysis is that, look, from the very beginning, leaders of the Democratic Party, which includes the financiers of that party, the money bags that are closely aligned with the leaders of the party. This is the establishment wing of the Democratic Party, and their whole game is to stop Sanders, right? And they've been upping their game here even before Super Tuesday. You know, and some of these candidates were thrown out there, allowed to go out there in the debates and so forth, you know, to test and see what kind of an impact they would have on Sanders, I believe. You know, Buttigieg, what, young, hoping to gain some of the youth vote away from Sanders and some of the gay vote, and then Klobuchar, some of the female vote, right? So they did not cut into Sanders' base and very much, and therefore, you know, their usefulness in that regard, I believe, they dropped out, clearly dropped out right before, the day before, and announced. The other tactic was to mobilize the older black vote, particularly in the South, South Carolina and other places. You know, it's kind of a phenomenon in the South. The Democratic Party has no base in the South except among the black vote there. And most of those votes that it controls through its influence on churches and community groups and politicians. Mobilize older black voters. And they pulled that plug on that, and it produced results. Younger black voters who tend not to vote very much, they're only like 10%, 15% of the total black voting population in the South, you know, went for Sanders, but their numbers were too small. Their numbers are too small. You don't have the Latino effect there. Because the South is a red state America. It's Trump America. And there's no way the U.S. And the Democrats are going to win any of those southern states, in my view. They're already lost. But look at South Carolina. 60% of the Democratic Party, the voting population, were black. And 85% of that 60% were over 35. And that's the group that listens to their churches, that listens to their community groups and politicians. And that's exactly what happened. They mobilized that, and big announcements by people like Representative Clyburn down there. And South Carolina turned very strongly for Biden. And that's true throughout the South, all the other primaries of Super Tuesday throughout the South. And those are the primaries that are yet to occur. The same thing is going to happen. Biden mobilized the South. At the same time, they launched this big Sanders is a socialist argument, which is a Republican argument, by the way, but they don't care. They use the same messaging. They even got some of the big financiers in the Democratic Party to say that if Sanders were the candidate, they were going to actually vote for Trump. Well, of course. Yeah, Sanders is going to take their big tax cuts away, and Trump gave it to him. That was going on. Their media, their mouthpieces, the CNN and so forth, MSNBC, were pumping this idea that talking heads if Sanders ran, they would lose down ballot. In other words, they would lose congressional seats in the House and Senate. All kind of arguments and all kind of messaging going on through their media and through their operatives in those states that Sanders can't win. Even though Sanders is leading Trump in national polls by more than any of the other candidates were. And then they pulled the tactic of getting those others to drop out. And their votes, of course, largely went to Biden. A good example was Klobuchar from Minnesota. And, Sanders was going to win Minnesota. And when Klobuchar dropped out and then made organized statements and turned her organization to get out the vote for Biden. That turned that whole election up there in Minnesota went for Biden. And of course, you got Warren, who was always splitting the progressive vote. And if Warren were not in the race, Sanders would have carried Massachusetts. But she wasn't, and she was there as well to drag votes, I believe, from Sanders. And of course, then we get after the Super Tuesday, we get Bloomberg dropping on and stating support for Biden, and Warren dropping out, but playing coy, really saying, "Okay, Sanders, you and Biden, come and tell me what you're going to do for me." Right. If I endorse either one of you, very opportunistic here by Warren. I've never trusted Warren. I think she was always playing the middle against the two ends, the conservative, the money bag wing and the progressive wing. On the other hand, that middle road. And of course, the middle road didn't work because what we got is a polarization in the Democratic Party. Going on. My latest piece is called, I wrote just a day or so ago, Super Tuesday and the Irrevocable Split in the Democratic Party. If you look at the Democratic Party today, what do you got? You've got a movement going on with Sanders, young folks, millennials, Gen Z, Xers, right, who are really hurting. These are the people in the last decade who have been taking it in the ear. In terms of jobs, poor paying jobs, service jobs, working multiple jobs, paying, usurious student loans, and high cost of education, no health care, to speak of. In general, just terrible conditions, and they know it. And there's not much hope they see of change in that. Who want Medicare for all, who are worried about living in a world of climate crisis, they and their children. So they're flocking. They're flocking to Sanders. And Sanders wins in the West very clearly. Why? Because you don't have the same dynamic of the black vote that you have in the South. It's not there. You have a larger number of minorities, Latinos and blacks and others, who are voting, are turning out for Sanders in the West. Sanders takes Colorado, Utah, I'm not sure about Arizona, California, very clearly. And of course, he will take Oregon and Washington when those primaries come up very soon as well. So, you've got this movement of youth, which is really a class movement because they're all working class people, see, against the establishment that has the older Democratic vote behind them and the older black vote behind them. And the older folks really don't want to shake the boat. They don't like Trump, right? But they're not going to go and vote for anything that upsets the status quo, you see. Just get rid of Trump and, we're about to retire and, we got our homes and things aren't all that bad. So that's the big split that's coming in the Democratic Party, whether it comes here in 2020 in the election, which is quite possible. If they go with Biden, Biden will lose. And because the Bernie supporters will stay home and the split will occur in the Democratic Party, if not before 2020, immediately after it. And that's my basic analysis. Okay, so we'll watch next week Michigan primary, which is really key, see who wins in the swing states. And that will prove who will be the candidate. And I predict that candidate will probably be Biden. They will have, the establishment will have checked Bernie once again. And the Bernie supporters, I don't think they're going to take a second time around being denied the nomination very lightly. And you will see a revolution occurring politically within the Democratic Party. And that party is heading for some big trouble because I don't believe Biden can win. And they will have split the party. And that's a real crisis in the Democratic Party. Okay. Well, that's it for today here. We're almost finished. And we will certainly come back. Follow my blog, jackrasmus.com, and my website. A lot of interviews going on by yours truly here with various radio stations and so forth on a day-to-day basis, talking about what's really happening here on a day-to-day basis. Very fluid, very fast-moving economic political situation. And we'll certainly pick up these same themes next week. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here. Streets are screaming now.